events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Wild and Scenic Film Festival on Saturday, May 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Clark College in Vancouver, Washington. The Wild and Scenic Film Festival will be screening a collection of 9 of the best short films from the 2019 festival. Before the screening, there will be a reception with beverages and light food and a raffle to support the Cascade Forest Conservancy. Again, that's the Wild and Scenic Film Festival on Saturday, May 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Clark College, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 1 o'clock. Coming up next, it's an interview from the APA Compass Archives from 2015. KBOO's DJ Diablo talks to author Richard Reeves about his book Infamy, the shocking story of the Japanese-American internment in World War II.
This is Diablo with KBOO Community Radio, and inspired by today's special programming for Asian Pacific American Day, I wanted to air this interview I did a few years back with Richard Reeves about the Japanese internment. My whole family's headed out to Minidoka, Idaho, where my father was born in a concentration camp during World War II. We're doing a pilgrimage. So I want to share this with you guys. Check it out. This is Tim Nakayama, and I'm here at KBOO Community Radio with the renowned author and journalist, Richard Reeves, who is the author of a brand new book. Can you tell us the title of your new book?
Infamy, the shocking story of the Japanese-American internment in World War II.
Being of Japanese-American ancestry, this has been a subject that I'm really fascinated by. But unfortunately, my grandparents, they didn't like to talk about it a whole lot. So having a resource like this is amazing. What inspired you to look into the subject?
Well, two things. One is I've lived a lot in California, and I'd ski at Mammoth, like a lot of Southern Californians. And when you drive up there, you're kind of in the middle of nowhere. And you passed Manzanar, or at least the gatehouse of what was Manzanar during the war. So as you're doing that, somebody in the car will invariably say, isn't that where they put the Japanese? And of course, it is one of the places that Japanese were incarcerated, Japanese Americans were incarcerated during the war. Beyond that, all the laws that made it possible for that to happen in the 1940s are still on the books, and we could do it. The Army could do it tomorrow to Muslims. They could do it to border crossers down in California, Texas. Supreme Court Justice Jackson, when the cases were first heard, said that those laws are like a loaded gun on the Constitution.
Yeah, I had interviewed my aunt down here recently about her experience as a three-year-old, and that's a question she asked. Was I think these laws are still in the books, and so yeah. I was trying to find that out, and you know, I wasn't that successful.
When the Supreme Court ruled on the four cases that came in 1944, the cases were held up so that they would be after the 1944 election. They dropped the charges against the defendants, but they didn't rule on the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of what had happened. Executive Order 9066 is not still on the book, but the things that made it possible are.
One thing I found fascinating in looking over this book that I didn't know about, and again, my grandparents didn't speak a whole lot about this when I was growing up, when you were talking about the bank accounts being frozen.
Right. I want to talk about both those things. The one is, you know, soldiers in combat rarely talk about what they saw and heard, especially to their families. And the Japanese Americans after the war, the Issei, the first generation, the older people who were, they were aliens because Japanese were not allowed to become citizens between 1924 and 1952. They didn't want to talk about what had happened. They were ashamed of it. They had been fiercely patriotic, and they did it willingly. They were told it would be for their own protection, although the machine guns and the guard towers and the searchlights were all pointed in, not out. But when the Black Civil Rights Movement came in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of young Japanese Americans began to ask their parents, you know, what did you do during the war, Daddy? And this was, I came into town yesterday, and this was, if I can, I want to read the lead obituary in the Oregonian yesterday.
Certainly.
It's Arlene Shigego Hashizuma, 93, passed away January 17. She was born in Kenya, Yazawa, in 1921, and raised in Portland, where her father was a small business owner. She graduated from Multnomah College in Secretarial Studies less than a year before she and her family were uprooted and incarcerated, first at the Pacific International Livestock Exposition in North Portland, then at Minidoka Concentration Camp in Hunt, Idaho. With the prevalent racism, she was unable to find work in her field and was employed as a domestic in her early adult years. Later, she worked as a secretary bookkeeper for several small businesses until she retired. So that was the story of one lady who died this week in Portland. Her life was, like many others, like 120,000 others, was just shredded. Her education meant nothing. Her patriotism meant nothing. Her citizenship meant nothing. She was in what amounted to a prisoner of war camp for 4 years.
Yeah, the euphemism of internment versus a concentration camp, and the kind of the meaning of concentration camps and how they've been used over in Europe with the Nazis.
Well, internment's a legal term, which means that a country has a right to intern aliens if it's at war with their country, enemy aliens, citizens of another country. Roosevelt, in signing the 9066, called them throughout the war concentration camps, because that's exactly what they were. They were built on the model. They were shabby things built on the model of prisoner of war camps. And then, of course, over the years, because of the Germans, the word concentration camp came to mean something different. It's hard when you write about this. And I found myself leaning on the word incarceration. I mean, these people were locked up. But you know, they were all Americans, and on both sides of the barbed wire, the people holding them in and the people being held in.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about, so the Japanese Imperial Navy bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. America freaks out. They go immediately to a lot of the Japanese American community leaders.
Right.
And arrest many of them.
They arrested more than 4,000 on the West Coast. The FBI did, and the Army, within 48 hours of Pearl Harbor. Anybody who had any kind of leadership position, a teacher, a journalist, businessman, a priest, a shop owner, it was like a Rotary Club dinner list. The list had nothing to do with anything other than the fact that these men, who were aliens, and 13 women, were arrested and put in federal prisons. Sometimes their families didn't know for a year or two where they were. The FBI swept down first on Terminal Island in Los Angeles and then Bainbridge Island in Washington State and just took these people away without explanation. They were never charged with anything. So Japanese Americans all over the West Coast, and most Japanese Americans lived on the West Coast, were burning everything they had, books, records, toys, dolls that looked Japanese, or burying it on their property, because having something like a Japanese language Bible, a knitting manual in Japanese, was going to get you taken away and put in prison. And then that was before 9066. 9066 came 2 months later. And then they rounded up every person with a drop of Japanese blood, including scouring the orphanages, finding Japanese children who had been adopted by Caucasians and took them away from their families too, and threw them into, here in Portland, into the livestock pavilions. In LA, they put them in Santa Anita, and they lived in stables, horse stables, for 3 months. And the conditions were terrible. The health was terrible. If you were sick, there were a lot of old people, obviously, and in hospitals, soldiers guarded you around the clock till you died, or until you were healthy enough to be sent to the stables, as it were.
Yeah. When I interviewed my aunt, even though she's only 3 years old, the smell that stuck with her, they were in a stall where horses had just been vacated.
Right. Some of them had a sense of humor about it. Down in Santa Anita, every family would say they were living in Seabiscuit's stall.
That's one thing I'm enjoying about your book, hearing more information than the general, just the basic story of how American citizens were kept from due process, and we're not given due process. You know, that's a story that you hear. When my mother met my father, who was born in camp, one of her friends from Canada said, "What does Keith think about the Japanese being interned during World War II?" And she's like, "What are you talking about?" She went to my dad and said, "You won't believe what my friend thinks." She's like, "Yeah, I was born in camp." So it was not in the history books. In the, you know, my mom was growing up, which had been probably in the 60s. And then when I was in high school, we had, you know, one, not even a paragraph, maybe two sentences in my history book. My daughter's history book, they had a couple pages, but they didn't get to it in middle school. So at least, the, you know, things are changing, more information. But a full book like this that has all these amazing stories and this information that I've never known before. Like, one thing I found really interesting was that finding about other races that were at war with America during World War II, the Italians and the Germans.
Right.
And there's a little story you mentioned that they didn't arrest someone's parents because he was a famous sports player.
The way the government set this up, because they didn't want to mention race, so that what Executive Order 9066 did was create war zones and give the Army the power to remove anyone from those zones that they chose. Well, the fact is that they chose almost exclusively Japanese Americans. There were a few Italians, a few Germans, but they couldn't do the same thing to Italians and Germans, because if they did, 50 million Americans would have been in the concentration camps. I mean, most of us have some German or Italian blood in us, and they gerrymandered the lines, particularly to avoid the home of one family in San Francisco, and that was the mother and father of Joe DiMaggio. That was 1941, the year he had 56 straight games, and the Army was at least wise enough. They were acting incredibly stupidly, but they at least were wise enough to know they couldn't pick up Joe DiMaggio's folks, who were enemy aliens. They had never, many, many Germans, many, many Italians had not filed naturalization papers. Japanese Americans couldn't. It was against the law since 1790. We had anti-Oriental laws beginning in 1790, but the people like Angelo Rossi, the mayor of San Francisco, Fiorello LaGuardia, the mayor of New York, were the children of enemy aliens. And in the East, nothing happened. Nothing was done to Japanese Americans who happened to live in New York or Pennsylvania, Illinois.
Yeah, so just along the West Coast, I see the little map.
It was the West Coast where the racism was much more intense here, because the Japanese Americans were an economic threat. They produced 40% of the agricultural product of this state, and the fear was real, of the Imperial Japanese. We were at war. The racism and the greed. Much of the land, the homes, the money held by Japanese Americans, they never saw again. That land ended up with, in many cases, Caucasian families. Houses were burned down or moved into. And a lot of the Japanese Americans didn't want to come back to the West Coast. They were afraid.
Yeah, my grandparents moved out to Chicago, and they lived out there for quite some time before they came back to the West Coast.
Chicago was the most welcoming city. It needed a lot of labor, and 20,000 Japanese. You were able to leave the camps if you had a job offer, or a college would accept you. All of that was arranged by the Quakers, by the American Friends Service. And 20,000 people went to Chicago, but it was a totally different world. One couple I talked to went to Indianapolis. She was a nurse, he was an accountant. And they lived in Indianapolis for 25 years before coming back here. And in 25 years, they never met a neighbor, all white, never met a neighbor who even had heard of the camps.
Yeah. It's a hidden shame of America this story. And I'm so glad that you've written this book to kind of bring this back into the consciousness and the possibility this could happen to other populations in
our
country.
Well, the laws are, as we said, the laws are still on the books.
You mentioned before, and something I didn't know, the FBI froze these bank accounts.
Their bank accounts were frozen within a week. And of course, if you were paying a mortgage or even rent or whatever, you couldn't do that. Some people who had been business people and had some sort of organization behind them were able to maintain their economic life, but almost everybody in the camps lost their economic life.
Yeah. I always thought it strange that my grandparents, especially my grandfather, always had money hidden somewhere
right.
in the home, money and also, you know, coins and gold and stuff like that.
Interesting.
And I thought it had to do with, you know, the Depression,
right.
Living through the Depression era. And then reading this, I was like, oh, that's probably partially
yeah.
why he would do that.
Well, there's a story about a couple of kids in Petaluma, California, who their most precious possession was a good camera. And they wrapped it and wrapped it in wax paper and tape and whatnot, and lowered it into a latrine on a coat hanger, a fish hook. And when they came back 4 years later, they pulled up the fish hook and they got the camera back.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Because cameras are one of the things that were taken from the Japanese Americans.
Yeah, the FBI came to my grandparents' home and seized their camera, took their radio, searched the house for any weapons.
Right.
I have actually a little story maybe I'd like to play for you when I interviewed my aunt, if you'd like to hear that.
I'd love
how
to.
The FBI came. Yeah, maybe we'll play that right now. Let's see if I can pull that up. This is Tim Nakayama.
Wait, who?
Diablo.
With KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. And this is another installment in our series of short radio documentaries. And today we continue to explore racism rearing its ugly head during wartime hysteria and the failure of our political leaders during this time of crisis.
We were born Americans. My parents were Americans. They had no connection with the Japanese in Japan. They were just as appalled at what happened at Pearl Harbor as anybody else. But they were treated like criminals because of the color of their skin, the shape of their eyes.
What happened on February 19th, 1942?
President Roosevelt, FDR, signed the Executive Order 9066.
A date which will live in infamy.
All rights were taken away. Every American right. They had no right even to vote. We were taken to the Expo Center first. And then we were assigned Minidoka, Idaho. That was our destination. But at that time, my mother told me she didn't know where they were going and how long they would be. Nobody knew their destination. Some people speculated that we might be put to death. Nobody knew.
Let's go back for a second.
FBI, open up. We need access to your home.
And when the FBI came, they searched the home. I even remember they took my dad's camera. My dad had a little camera, and they took that. They asked me, little girl, do you know of any guns in your home? They wouldn't believe my mom and dad. They thought maybe a little girl would know. And I said, yes, there is. And so they said, tell me where it is. So I said, well, you have to pull that long thing down. It was a ladder from the attic, and my mother and father were looking at each other, wondering what does Joni know that we don't know? So I took them upstairs to the attic, and we opened up a trunk. And inside the trunk were toy pistols that were actually belonging to my uncle, Jerry. And so it made them kind of red-faced and they started laughing.
So it's a funny little story.
Yeah, it is a
humor.
Funny story. That was a bit of humor. That was humor. That is like, you know, pie in the face type of thing.
Interesting that one of your cousin's children
is an FBI agent today. That's right. He is.
So that was a story, part of a series of documentaries I'm doing with my aunt. And we were talking about the FBI, and the camera kind of made me think of that. And also, the title of your book,
Infamy.
Infamy. And, you know, FDR would say, day that will live in infamy. And the infamy that I was thinking when I was doing the story was the infamy.
Years of it.
Yeah, infamy of what they did to the Japanese Americans.
Yeah, the little girl going up and with the toy guns. Ezio Pinza, the lead basso of the Metropolitan Opera, later the star of South Pacific, was an Italian alien living in Bronxville, New York. And five FBI agents came to his house, took the place apart. They put him in jail. He was in jail for 5 months, for he did nothing. But as they were leaving the house, like the toy guns, an FBI agent saw that there was a letter in Italian on the wall and said to Pinza, "What is that?" And Pinza said, "That's a letter from Verdi." And the FBI agent said, "Who's Verdi?" That's what hysteria is like. And the reason Pinza was picked up was that the second basso at the Metropolitan Opera, who wanted his job, told the FBI that Pinza was a friend of Mussolini's, which he was not, and that he signaled to Mussolini on the Saturday afternoon Metropolitan Opera broadcast from New York, and they threw Pinza in jail. He had a nervous breakdown, and if it weren't for Fiorello LaGuardia, he'd still be there.
Yeah, when I was reading this, I saw that. Who's that, you know, on the wall? Yeah. And I thought of this story. I'd see if you were interested in hearing that. And then also,
there was nothing sophisticated about it because none of these people had done anything.
Yeah. When in your book, you're talking about how they were accusing him of signaling Mussolini by changing the pitch of his voice to what he was singing in the opera. You talked also about books and the knitting, Pearl One.
Knitting manual. Knit One, Pearl Two. Because to the FBI, who didn't understand any Japanese, they looked like their image of what a code book would look like.
Yeah.
And there was all this craziness that people in Palos Verdes or people here were signaling out to sea to the Japanese. Well, the first place, there were no Japanese out at sea. In the second place, no one was signaling them. One of the stories was spread by Earl Warren, who was then the Attorney General of California, was that the Japanese were planting their tomatoes to point arrows at airfields and factories, defense factories and army bases, so that Japanese planes flying over, there were no Japanese planes flying over the mainland, would be guided in to bomb them. It was like insanity.
The information that they had of false information that they would propagate about, well, they're trying to set up near power plants and military bases and, you know, those kind of things.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But, of course, they had been there before the power lines, the Japanese were farming the worst land in the state. The Japanese Americans were farming the worst land on the West Coast. So, yes, they were getting land near power lines. And the factories and military bases didn't exist. The Japanese-American farmers were there before they were built.
Yeah. And, you know, even though their information was sent back to the East Coast saying, hey, some of this is inaccurate, they kind of went with it anyway. Kind of reminds me of some of the stuff that happened in Iraq.
It was like
a
message to Garcia,
you know?
The kind of thing where, by the stories. But the fact of the matter is not much information at all got back to the East Coast. And people in the rest of the country either didn't know this was going on or they were being misled by what amounted to propaganda that these camps were like resorts.
Yeah. When I was doing research, I pulled up a bunch of old newsreels, and they show them everyone smiling, getting on the trains, you know, a soldier handing an apple up to a child in the train.
Right.
The reality was, this is in times of Nazi Germany, and you're getting on a train, and they black out the windows. You have no idea where you're going.
Right.
No
due
process.
Trains were sealed.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of children, I remember reading somewhere that over half of the interned Japanese were children.
Right.
Are you familiar with that?
Well, two-thirds of the people who were incarcerated were American citizens, and they were the young ones. They were remarkable people, really, that the the older young people, many of them were either students or graduates of Stanford, of Berkeley, of UCLA, and they set up schools in the first in the assembly centers, and then the camps throughout the barren, wild West. And really, by the end of the war, they had recreated small American towns of 18,000, 20,000 people with 80 baseball leagues at Manzanar, Boy Scout troops in every camp. I mean, the Japanese were determined to show they were more American than the Americans. And in terms of their loyalty, they were, which they proved later when the young ones went into the army and formed the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which became the most decorated per capita unit in American military history. So it was, they were, again, there were Americans on both sides of the barbed wire, but in many cases, the ones inside were more fiercely loyal than the ones outside.
442nd, that was my next question, so I'm glad you mentioned that. That's great. You want to talk about that a little bit more?
Well, people realize, by the way, Milton Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower's brother, General Eisenhower's brother, was the first director of the War Relocation Authority. He quit the job because he couldn't sleep, because he knew what was doing was wrong, it was unconstitutional, and totally ineffective. And there had never been a single act of Japanese-American sabotage, either on the mainland or in Hawaii. And Earl Warren, the Attorney General of California, who rode the Japanese to the governorship and eventually to Chief Justice of the United States, was the guy who thought who spread the story, the theory that the fact that there had been no Japanese American sabotage was proof they were holding back and planning for a big one. One big strike at the United States. Well, as that, none of that, of course, ever happened. And as the war went on, and it was expensive to keep these camps going, and a lot of people knew, though they weren't saying in public, that this was craziness, they began to draft or ask for enlistments from young Japanese Americans. And 30,000 Japanese Americans served in the American military by the end of the war. 18,000 of them were casualties. And there also were 6,000 secret military men, the Military Intelligence Service, serving in the Pacific. The American people never knew this. And these were the guys, these were the guys who could speak Japanese, because most Japanese Americans couldn't, not the young ones. And they were the interrogators, translators, and the cave flushers. The Imperial Japanese, rather than surrender, would blockade themselves in caves, and these kids would go in and talk them out. It was called cave flushing. They had no weapons. The Japanese in there had, the Imperial Japanese soldiers had weapons. And General MacArthur's chief intelligence office, General Willoughby, said he thought that those 6,000 men, the MIS, had shortened the war by 2 years and saved 1 million lives.
Wow, that's fascinating. I love hearing all the statistics and the information. Like, I'd never heard about the cave flushers before. Uh-huh. And, you know, there were, I think you in the book you mentioned there's over 3,000 Japanese Americans that were already in the military before.
They were dismissed on December 8th.
Oh, okay.
Except for one guy I could find, and he was the star softball pitcher for a regimental team. So they said he was a Filipino when he stayed in.
Baseball, you know, softball or whatever. They keep him.
Yeah.
DiMaggio and then. Okay.
They were, you know, Norm Mineta, who became the mayor of San Jose and then a congressman. And then a member of the cabinet of the United States, was 8 years old, and he was going to Manzanar and he was bringing his glove, a ball, and a bat. And the Army took the bat from him. And he turned to his father and he said, "Why is the Army afraid of me?" And he later, there's some great stories that come out of this. He was a Boy Scout, almost all the young boys were. And he was at Heart Mountain near Cody, Wyoming. And a scoutmaster in Cody got the idea, a very decent, intelligent man, of having the white kids from Cody go down to the camp at Heart Mountain and have camporees, as they called them, with the Japanese-American scouts. And Norman, and then they would have one white kid and one Japanese-American kid in a pup tent. And Normanetta's roommate in that was Alan Simpson, who later became a senator from the state of Wyoming. And they remained lifelong friends.
That's wonderful. A lot of times racism is perpetuated when you don't know much about the person or that race, you know, but actually being exposed and having close contact and seeing that they're just another human being,
right,
really makes a huge difference.
Well, there was a good deal of that, particularly in Oregon and Washington, more than in California, where people were farmers at this part of the world, sometimes fishermen, and so they were neighbors, even though they didn't live closely together. They had to help each other, and so in many cases, the people, the white people, did take care of their neighbors' lands. And when those Japanese Americans came home, they found that their houses had been taken care of, their land had been taken care of, and the Caucasian neighbors had saved their profits. However, the other side of that, which happened here, was the story of Mount Hood in Oregon, which I had been to Mount Hood because I once did a book retracing the Oregon Trail. And Mount Hood, Hood River, the town and the county, is one of the most beautiful places on the planet, with the Columbia River Gorge and Mount Hood. And there were 431 Japanese living there before the war. They were farmers, cherries, mainly Mount Hood apples, which were famous all around the country. This is what happened in Mount Hood, which became famous or notorious. When the war began, on December 8th, the day after the war, or the week after the war, Oak Grove High School, the local high school, the high school newspaper had this poem in it. "To those of Hood River, if you please, they are our friends, these Japanese, not Japs or even Japanese. They are Americans, our schoolmates, these." Then, after the war, the American Legion, 14 young men, Japanese Americans from Hood River, had served in Europe. And the American Legion post on the local courthouse had posted the names of, as all towns did, of everyone serving. And one night they painted out all the Japanese names. And then they put an ad in the local paper and posted on trees and phone poles and whatnot. "Statement to returning Japanese. Under the War Department's recent ruling, you will soon be permitted to return to this county." Now in caps, "For your own best interest, we urge you not to return." And it took the Army to come into Hood River, this beautiful little town, now kind of a funky, wind sailing capital of the world, town. And the Army had to come in for the Japanese Americans who wanted to go back to their properties, to get them back there.
Wow. When you say that, it reminds me of, you know, during the Civil Rights Movement, when they were integrating schools, you know, where the Army and the police would have to escort the African American students to school?
Well,
this is pre.
Two of the camps were in Arkansas, so in Little Rock, where one of the places where the Army had to get black students into Little Rock High School, there is a small Japanese community there. There are two things about that. One is a woman down there told me, you know, they say that the blacks integrated Little Rock High School. They didn't. The Japanese Americans did. And then when those little girls who became famous went into school and everyone boycotted, the only students that went in with them were the Japanese Americans.
Oh, I love that. That's great. I want to go back to when you're talking about the loyalty of the Japanese Americans,
right.
Japanese in general, that were living in America. You know, the information that the military intelligence was getting was that the Japanese, imperial Japanese, didn't want anything to do with the Japanese here. They were too loyal, kind of like racial traitors or
right.
cultural traitors.
Yeah, cultural traitors is what the Japanese, imperial Japanese called them. We knew that was true. And by the way, the President of the United States knew that was true, as did the other people involved in putting the Japanese American into concentration camps. A very smart lieutenant commander in the Navy, fluent in Japanese, he had been worked in the embassy in Tokyo for 6 years. His name was Ringel. And he was given permission to take safe crackers at a San Quentin prison, which they used to break into the safes of Japanese consulates around the country. And what they found in there were memos saying, do not trust any Japanese Americans. They're all loyal. Concentrate on recruiting spies among Negroes and communists. So that they knew that when they were putting these people into camps. And it and then, you know, some people were jailed for years because they were Americans, but they happened to be working in Japanese consulates around the country, including one fellow who was a lawyer from Hood River.
Hmm. When I came across that story, I was meaning to ask you about that too, about the safecracker. I thought it was so fascinating
yeah.
that they took someone out of jail.
It didn't start with Watergate.
You know, and broke in. They took a safecracker out of jail, San Quentin. Amazing story. You also talked about General DeWitt. Is that correct?
Yes.
You want to talk about him?
John DeWitt.
He
was a 62-year-old leftover from the from World War I, and our army wasn't much between the wars, but they were pretty mediocre people. He was not only mediocre, but he was a racist, a fool, and he was the commander of the Fourth Army, which was the West Coast, and he, with the help of Earl Warren and the blessing of people like Walter Lippmann and Edward R. Murrow, was the one behind the rules that set the incarceration. He was the one who wanted every person with one drop of Japanese blood to be incarcerated outside his area. And his headquarters were at the Presidio in San Francisco. And when he found out that the first 10 members of the MIS, the 6,000 men I talked about who did so much in the war, were actually being trained in the Presidio in another part, he immediately had them rounded up and sent to Minnesota. And then ironically, the people of Minnesota, as these young Japanese were secretly training, Japanese Americans, they would invite them home for the weekend and meet their families and whatnot. It was totally different than the racism of the West Coast.
Interesting. Any stories that we haven't touched upon that you want to mention about your book? Maybe interest readers to go out and get this and read more about?
There are great stories. And surprising, I think, the Japanese Americans who fought in Italy, the 442nd and the 100th Battalion were from both Hawaii and the mainland. And they were quite different people. The mainland Japanese Americans were educated. They were light-skinned. They spoke perfect English. And they had great obligations to their families. The Hawaiians were plantation workers. They were much darker skinned because they worked outdoors all day, and they spoke a kind of Creole, which of English, Japanese, and Hawaiian, and they were one rough, tough bunch of guys. Drink, sing, gamble, and they brought them all together. When the Army finally got it and said that it could use these guys as soldiers, and that they were good soldiers, but the problem was they were at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and the mainland guys and the Hawaiians were fighting all the time, really fighting, and they didn't like each other at all, and the Hawaiians couldn't understand why these snooty mainland Japanese Americans wouldn't gamble, wouldn't drink. They didn't know they were sending all their money back to their families in the camps. And finally, a guy down there got the idea. There were two camps in Arkansas, as I mentioned before. He took busloads of the Hawaiians, led by a sergeant named Dan Inouye, who later lost an arm in Italy, won the Medal of Honor, and became a U.S. senator, longest-serving U.S. senator in history, and took them to the camps. And they thought, when the Hawaiians saw the camps, they thought they were prisoner of war camps, which they were. They were tar paper shacks built exactly the same as POW camps, and the machine guns were pointing in, the tanks guns were pointing in, and they spent a weekend at the camp. Then they came back to Shelby, because the Army had been thinking of breaking up the unit, just because there was so much internal fighting. And they came back, and Inouye and the others said, look, these guys, the mainland Japanese Americans, they're better people than we are. We're fighting for the country because we love it. They're fighting for the country, and the country has put their own parents in concentration camps. So there are, you know, there are hundreds of stories like that as people got to know each other. And then, of course, that unit. But even then, the 442nd was the first unit to get to the outskirts of Rome, which was the first Axis capital that we captured in the war. When they did that, they had become famous without anyone knowing who they were when they rescued the so-called Lost Battalion. It was a battalion of Texans who were trapped by Germans. And the New York Times on its front page reported about this great rescue of this battalion by dedicated doughboys, they called them, never mentioning the doughboys were Japanese Americans. Now this same unit has gotten first to Rome, or the outskirts of Rome, and they're ordered to hold for 2 days so that white troops can go in under Mark Clark and claim the victory in Rome.
Wow.
So it was, Mark Clark, by the way, having said that, was a great champion of the Nisei battalions, but he still led only white troops into Rome. And they trucked the Japanese Americans around Rome. This, it was such, Easter 1943, Eleanor Roosevelt visits the camps. Eleanor Roosevelt was against the camps, but there's only so much she could say publicly, obviously. She visits three camps on that Easter week. Her husband, meanwhile, is visiting Army bases. And by then, there were, again, Japanese Americans in the service, in the Air Force and the Army. The Navy never would accept them. And they, when Roosevelt was coming, they rounded up the Japanese-American soldiers, put them in trucks, took them to aircraft hangars 10 miles outside the camps and locked them in there until the president was gone, so the president wouldn't see any Japanese-Americans and no Japanese-Americans would see the president.
Hmm. Interesting. Wow. So we talked a little bit about how some people were very fortunate that they had neighbors that would help take care of their stuff. Kind of the heroes bucking the system and bucking, you know, the general hysteria of the war. My grandparents were very fortunate that they had friends and neighbors that would take on their like heirlooms, family heirlooms, kimonos and Japanese art and stuff, and held on to those throughout the war until they returned. Do you want to talk about any heroes in your book?
Any heroes in
the book? People that did stuff like that, other stories or other people, whether it be...
There was a farmer named Dutch Leonard who had been a Major League Baseball pitcher. There were two of them. He was the first one in the 20s. He was a farmer in California and took all the neighbors around and took care of their property. And then when they came back, their properties were in good shape, and he gave them half the profit. He had worked the farms with his people, half the profit they had made while they were in jail. Some of the same things happened on Bainbridge Island, off Washington, where it was terrible. They were marched off they were rounded up. They were all strawberry farmers out there, and they were rounded up. First, a curfew was put on the Japanese Americans, as it was every place, and the curfew was 8 o'clock, which meant that the Japanese American graduates of Bainbridge High School, this is the story of Snow Falls on Cedars, the novel, could not go to their prom or to their graduation, and then they were marched to the ferries, taken to Seattle, where the people waited and spit on them as they came off. On the Bainbridge side, their friends were crying, particularly the kids' friends, the high school kids, and were holding, the Japanese could not take their dogs or cats or pets, Japanese Americans, were holding the pets of the kids who were being sent to the camps, and the pets all died. They wouldn't eat when the people left. So it was not the kind of thing you expected to happen in America. And when some Japanese tried to get east of the Cascades or east of the Sierras, where outside the war zone, when they tried, they were met by mobs with shotguns. No one would give them water. No one would sell them gasoline or food. And they were driven back to California and into the camps. It was worse than when the Okies came.
Are you familiar with the term gaman? Do you come across that?
That's the way things are.
The way I understand it, my aunt, when I interviewed her, talked about it. It's a Japanese term meaning enduring, unbearable
yes,
with patience and dignity.
Right.
Persevering through that. My aunt would talk a lot about that in the camp, that, you know, that's gaman, you know, stick with it.
Do you remember the other expression?
One of the tragedies, there's lots of tragedies, but it's a minor tragedy, is that my father being born in camp, my grandparents didn't teach him Japanese, you know?
Right.
It's part of that. You know, we're American. He's going to speak English.
Right.
My aunt speaks Japanese. And with my father not learning Japanese, that's something I didn't really learn. I know a few
terms. These were proud people who had lived. You know, they were thrown into these tarpaker shacks in lands where the summer temperatures were 120 degrees and the winters were 30 degrees below zero. No one had ever lived in these places before, and no one lived in them after. Yet they were proud. They were a proud people who had set up schools, churches, the baseball leagues we mentioned, the Boy Scout troops, sock hops. The kids were like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland movies. I mean, that's who they were. They were American kids. And to a certain extent, some of the kids didn't mind it at all because they were allowed to run a little wilder than they ever could at home. But the army hired people to do basically propaganda on the camps, and among them were great photographers, Ansel Adams, Dorothea Lange, both famous, both great, but all their work was censored. The guns and the soldiers were always cropped out, and the Japanese were too proud to have themselves depicted as victims, so that when Adams or Lange would arrive, they all had their best clothes on, their best smiles, even though they were living in these barracks with no toilet facilities, no cooking facilities, no water facilities, sometimes 8-10 people to a 12-by-18 room, one electric light per barrack, just like a POW camp. And but when they posed for those, when they came for those pictures, they were sitting there, and they might as well have been in a comfortable apartment in San Francisco in their best clothes. They were too proud to be photographed the way they were living, with sand coming in. It was so damn hot that they had to dig foxholes under the barracks so they could put the children in them during the day, because it was the coolest spot in places like Arizona and Manzanar.
Yeah. Swamps or deserts. My aunt always remembers when they got off the train, there was a terrible sandstorm, and my grandmother was just crying and crying. She goes, I'm in hell. This is hell. They thought they'd arrived in hell.
They had.
Yeah.
And the sandstorms came and went. In Manzanar was where the Owens Lake had been, and that water was all drained to L.A., so that there was always a foot of dust on the ground. There was a perpetual low sandstorm. I have a story in there about a young girl from, actually a pretty famous opera singer from San Diego, who, when she found out they were going from Santa Anita, where they were living in the stables, to Tule Lake, the camp at Tule Lake, California, which is on the Oregon border. And so she immediately went out and got a bathing suit to bring with her, not knowing that there had been no water at Tule Lake for 5 million years. It was now a lava bed and a terrible place. They were all terrible places.
I pulled up on the internet. Gambaru is another term. I may be totally butchering that, meaning to stand firm. I don't know if that's doing one's best, toughing it out.
Right.
That might be the term.
Well, there was. I mean, it was that personal ethic of the Japanese Americans, or their culture, that there was no resistance. They felt that this was their, at the beginning, they felt that this was their duty. Now, after a while, when they saw how they were being treated, and they were under guns, and some were killed, shot, killed, for breaking a rule, there was some anger. But as you probably know better than I, the amount of enduring bitterness is almost zero. I mean, these are the most now successful, patriotic Americans. And the other stories told us who the villains were of this. Roosevelt, Earl Warren knew what he had done. And even in his memoir, he only wrote one sentence saying that it was a mistake to have it. However, in California, Berkeley does long oral histories of its governors. The woman who did his, Amelia Fry, talked to him for 6 days, and on the sixth day she finally said that, now I want to talk to you about the events of 1942. Earl Warren, then the Chief Justice of the United States, burst into tears and walked out of the room and never came back. There is no doubt in my mind, I mean, if there is redemption, part of it is that there's no doubt in my mind that Brown versus Topeka, the desegregation decision in 1954, crafted by Warren, was because of the guilt he felt about what he had done in 1942.
That's fascinating. Yeah, there's another book that I it was called The Art of Gaman. They looked at how they had done artwork
right.
in the desert, in other places to do, you know, to kind of endure. My grandfather, they had actually had access to library materials, and he got some books on electronics, and it became an electrician. Camp electrician, and he actually built out of scrap parts a radio,
right?
And they put it in an old orange crate and covered it with wire and stuff, and kind of hide. And they cover themselves and listen to the stories late at night because they weren't allowed to have radios, and just being really creative and
they weren't
having
allowed
ingenuity.
To have cameras either.
No,
and there were famous Japanese photographers who disguised cameras as lunchboxes. And some of the pictures in my book were taken from those lunchback cameras. They were great. You were talking about heroes. The oddest hero, in a way, was Sears Roebuck. Sears Roebuck was the only, they were doing it for money, but they were the only way that people could get things in. And the other heroes were librarians. Particularly in San Diego, but other places too, those were the people who were getting books to the camps. And when I mentioned the camps became small towns, they all also had daily newspapers put out totally by the incarcerated, censored sometimes by the camp administrators.
This is radio, so we can't really show the pictures, but there's some lovely pictures here.
And while you're talking about images, I'm sure the most striking image in there is the cartoon of the Japanese coming down the coast and picking up dynamite and looking out telescopes. Yeah, looking out telescopes. And the line was looking for signals from home, Tokyo. That cartoon was done by the editorial cartoonist of PM, a newspaper in New York, and his name was Theodore Geisel, though we know him better as Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, I meant to mention that too. I'm glad you reminded me, because you know, I read Dr. Seuss all as a kid, and read it to my daughter, my nephews, and niece, and it's interesting to see that.
Well, he was able to redeem himself, as I guess Warren was.
Yeah, redemption. Do you want to say anything about what you're going to do tonight?
I'm going to be at Powell's.
Uh huh.
And I think it's at 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
I suppose I'll talk about 20 minutes. You can see I have no trouble talking.
Yeah.
Are you gonna, and then answer questions and sign books. And
so are you just going to wing it? Do you have a certain progression that you usually talk about when you go speak at the bookstore?
I tend to start with the fact that this treatment of newcomers to America didn't start with Japanese Americans, and it didn't end with slavery, the Indians, every immigrant group who came, the Chinese to build the railroads, the Eastern Europeans for the slaughterhouses and the steel mills, Irish need not apply, the Jews, they all were discriminated against openly because they were not like us until they were us. And we are all of them, and it's the great, there are dark corners in our history, and this is certainly one of them, but we are the country at our best, our better angels, as Lincoln said, of all these people who came from different places and were treated like dirt in the beginning.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing that part. Anything else you want to say about when you're on tour, what you...
The one thing that has been amazing to me, because I've written a lot of books and have done a lot of this, I'm very moved all the time. Every place I've gone, there have been substantial crowds of Japanese Americans, often people very old, and who come up and thank me for doing this. I've never had that kind of reputation, and I saw myself writing a book because I was afraid this could happen again, because the law still exists, because Americans still disdain the other, in this case Muslims and Latinos, but I just never had people say thank you for doing this. Very moving.
I want to thank you. This is a fascinating book. It's wonderful, really well written, compelling. It's a page turner, you know. You keep going. The stories, the personal stories are so...
It's a page turner because the people are interesting.
Yes. So thank you for your time.
I'm Richard Reeves, and the book is called Infamy, The Shocking Story of the Japanese-American Internment During World War II.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was fun. Interesting.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 1:59. Coming up next, Lit Fantastic host Neil Aitken talks to writers Lee Herrick and Lynn Maitani about their personal obsessions and how it finds its way into their works. At 3, KBOO DJ Sun Lee takes to the airwaves with his special APA Heritage Day playlist. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
This is The Lit Fantastic, a podcast series about authors and their obsessions. I'm your host, Neil Aitken. In this episode, I speak with Lee Herrick, a good friend of mine who happens to be the former poet laureate for Fresno City, California, and the author of two books of poetry, Guardian Secrets of the Dead and This Many Miles from Desire. We talk about his obsession with institutions. One of the things I like about this particular episode is how a discussion about institutions and Lee's interest and obsession with them becomes a larger discussion about our humanity and the way that some of these institutions can dehumanize us, while at the same time we can have opportunities to restore humanity and rebuild community through the positions we have within an institution. So let's drop into the conversation at the point when Lee is sharing with me his experience as a poet laureate.